Welcome to the Jay Martin Show. My name is Jay Martin. I'm an investor and the CEO of Cambridge House. And my guest today is Vince Lancey. Vince is the managing partner at Echo Bay Partners. And this was maybe one of the more educational conversations that I've had on the channel, because I really just got to pick Vince's brain on so many topics that I understand at a surface level, but want some more depth, right? Like the nuances between monetary policy and fiscal policy, because so frequently in, you know, macro literature these days, these terms are used interchangeably, and that is incorrect. I really wanted to dive into why today and how they interact in our lives separately, but how that's also changing with implementation of ideas like MMT, modern monetary theory. Now, again, I understand what MMT is, but what I really wanted to gather from Vince was, you know, how does this change my life as a consumer, as a retail investor, as a business owner? You know, what's the intention behind this? And what's the vision for how life will be like on a transactional basis, on a wealth creation, a wealth preservation basis after full implementation of MMT? And is this path inevitable? Is there any way around this, right? Lots of strong opinions on this subject. You could probably guess mine, and you'll definitely get it in this interview. We got pretty raw a few times, but super, super fun. So I really hope you enjoyed this as much as I did, because I feel like I have to have Vince back on the show now, because, you know, sometimes we do these interviews and in an hour I wrap up. You know, I try to keep my conversations to about an hour, but sometimes an hour comes and goes and I really just wish that we had more time. Today was one of those conversations. So anyways, here is Vince Lancey, the managing partner at Echo Bay Partners. This is the Jay Martin Show. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Vince Lancey. Vince, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
It's great to meet you. Thanks for making the time, for coming on the show. And I'm excited to jump into like a whole web of topics here. But why don't we begin, Vince, for anybody who's not familiar with who you are and what you do, just give us the highlight reel of how you spend your time.
Okay. Well, career-wise, by training, I'm an options market maker trader. So I'm very well-versed in options theory, commodities, and trading risk management. I manage money with a hedge fund, managed money running my own fund in the past, did a lot of options trading. And now what I do is, I've actually stumbled into it. We can talk about it at length some other time, but I've started educating, not in the commonplace way, but on Sundays I have a two-hour class. I have a bunch of friends on with, and we talk about serious topics. And during the week, I put a newsletter out for guys, and we talk trading all day long. That's what I do. Trade for my own account.
Got it. Okay. So what's catching your attention in the market right now? And look at like any macro forces down to the granular stuff, Vince.
Yeah. I mean, there are guys that'll give you asset allocations and predictions, and I certainly can do that, but I'm very reticent to do that without knowing the audience's predilections. But something that's really caught my eye, and it scratched an area in my brain that I just could not, you know, itch, was the whole MMT thing. I did some research into that, and what I found was quite surprising and is consistent with what we're seeing economically and administratively with the Biden administration and the path that the economy is going on. And it's, without being too dystopian about it, it's a little bit disturbing, actually, but it's reality.
Okay. So I want to pull on that thread, but you know what, a nice place to begin would be, can you clarify a little bit for me, Vince, the difference between fiscal policy and monetary policy as you see it?
Sure, sure. Monetary policy is, I'm not a professor. I'll use English. Monetary policy is someone like the Fed affects short-term interest rates. They're attempting to smooth out the bumps and slopes in economic recoveries and recessions. So moving short-term interest rates is monetary policy. That's all it is, you know, essentially. Fiscal covers a little bit more in terms of tools in their toolkit. But fiscal is more important. Fiscal is longer term. Fiscal covers the ability to tax or not tax. Fiscal covers the ability to issue debt, which is bonds or not bonds. Mm. So when you combine them, if you're looking at, say, a bond market, the short-term rates are dominated by Fed or monetary behavior, right? And fiscal policy affects your long-term interests, 30-year bonds. So if the Fed were to raise rates, that's a monetary change. If the government were to raise taxes or issue debt, that's fiscal. And both of those are very important for the economy. And you'll notice, and we know this, that the Fed handles monetary policy and the Treasury handles fiscal. So they're actually separated within our government.
Yeah, and the terms are often used interchangeably. And that's why I wanted to ask you to clarify that difference, because they're not the same. And so those little nuances, they're not little nuances, they're significant nuances, are important. Okay, now, so driving back towards MMT, obviously huge discussion over the last like 12, 18 months, you know, are we there, right? Is this present in our system, or is this something we're still looking forward to?
We have entered the MMT zone, okay? They may not be, and I don't mean they in a conspiratorial way. The people that want to implement it may not wave a red flag, and they may not be hiding it, but the behavior of Fed governors and policy changes are moving in the direction of MMT. So I can say that we've crossed the line. We are on the slope of MMT, and we won't announce it until it's too late. And by too late, I mean until it's already been largely implemented. It's not something you want to talk about. You're trying to change the culture of a country.
So I want you to expand on that. So we're talking about modern monetary theory, if the acronym is not familiar to you. And what is the shift? Like, what are the core changes that you and I, as consumers, investors, civilians, experience in this monetary shift?
That's the most important question, right? Everyone talks about it, and there's a lot of disdain for it. But it would help to really know what it is. And I'm glad you asked me that, because I was asked that about 6 months ago, and I couldn't really answer. So I had to figure it out myself.
Interesting.
When you look at MMT, it's what's called, without going too much down a rabbit hole, it's what's called as an heterodox or unorthodox economic policy. So the mainstream has not accepted it yet. Parenthetically, that's why you won't brag about it while you're doing it. The second part of it is, while we, I assume you as well, look at money as a private good, a store of value, and a means of transfer or a medium of exchange, for MMT treats money as, and I'm almost quoting it here, as a public utility or a public commons of the public. And what that means is, it means money is a public utility. Money is not a value. Money is something that is used to facilitate transactions. It is beads or puka shells, but it is not gold or silver. You follow?
So we keep the unit of exchange, we lose the store of value. Is that correct?
Right. But that's exactly it. And it's harder to describe these concepts. I'm not well versed in it. An academic probably could, but it's easier to give it as a practical example to people who are living it. And that is, it is a stated fact. Fact in parentheses, or quotes, I should say these days. It's a fact that modern monetary theory does not believe the supply of money has any direct effect on inflation or deflation.
Right.
Period. Which means, back to what you were just bringing up, modern monetary theory has no use for monetary policy. Interest rates at zero are zero. We're not going to raise interest rates to slow down inflation. We don't believe that money is the root of inflation, or can be the root of. We don't believe that money. Too much money creates inflation. It's kind of like the anti-Mises. I'm not a Mises person, but you have to know it if you're in our business.
Yeah.
So the more money we print, the orthodox economist, the greater chance we have of inflation. Modern monetary theory says the supply of money does nothing to create inflation, right? And I know nothing should be in quotes, but it's not. And we'll get to that's the contradiction of it. And I'm not even attacking it yet. Okay. It believes money is an impediment to economic growth, meaning to the extent that people hoard it or don't use it, they're slowing down growth. They want money to flow. So money is, for them, an impediment to growth, and inflation, now your next question has to be, well, what about inflation, right? Inflation is not a monetary phenomenon. That's the first part. I'll wait for you to ask me a question before I say
Yeah. Okay. So a couple things I want to pull on there. Like the original definition of inflation, we talk about inflation in terms of price inflation often today, right? Asset mm-hmm. inflation, price inflation. But correct me if I'm wrong, like if we were to dial it back to sort of the origin of the word, it was always about monetary inflation. Price inflation was just a symptom of increasing the money supply. Is that correct? Now we talk about inflation, like our cereal, our groceries, our et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's another conversation that we could really get into in an almost philosophical way. But hard money people, Austrian economists, will say, just by creating the money, you create inflation. They draw the line at where the money is created, right? So what they're saying is the inflation has been created. It's a matter of time for it to manifest, whether it be in one asset or another. So right. There's your price comment, right? What you said is very true. Then there are people who believe, and I believe this is more than modern monetary. Well, then there's the people that are in the middle. Let's call those normal people, right? I think we're in that category. And then there's people, not that Mises is not normal. I think it's actually very sound. Then there's people to the left or right, to the other side of that. And those people think that you don't have inflation until you have high velocity of money, right? So if you remember, they talk about M2 and the velocity of money. So you don't have inflation until the velocity of money picks up. Now, that concept has been proven largely correct as a result of the behavior of markets in the greater financial crisis in 2008, meaning we printed a lot of money, but we didn't get inflation. Why is that? Because the money never achieved critical velocity.
Right.
Essentially, without getting too much into it, the money was printed. QE, quantitative easing, is the simultaneous printing of money and buying of bonds. So the money is buying bonds. The money's not really floating in the market. It's just lowering interest rates, making you and me say, well, bonds are yielding 0%. I guess I'll buy that share of stock now.
Right.
So there's an example of someone saying to Mises' group, well, money was printed and we don't have inflation. So there is a difference. So I think the question that I cannot answer that you're asking is what is inflation? Well, inflation is either at the origin of printing, or inflation is at the origin of price symptom, which is what we're seeing now.
And following your comments that, you know, MMT is the transition from money being a store of value and a unit of exchange to just being a unit of exchange, right? It makes sense, therefore, that you can make the claim that expanding the money supply is not creating inflation because you're not actually increasing money as a store of value, unless, I guess, we start thinking about money as strictly, if there's no store of value, that should inspire greater velocity. That's what I guess where I'm going with this. Does that make sense?
No reason to hold it, right? No, I think I see the path that you're on. And I think you're describing, just speaking for whoever believes in MMT as a way to be right now, which, by the way, actually is Marxist. We'll get into that in a second. But if you believe in MMT, you're going to run into people like you that are going to say that. And what I believe MMTers want to say to you is this: money isn't a store of value at all. The store of value is in creating economic good. And so they want to break us of that mindset culturally. And that's the best answer I can give, because if we go down a different path, I think you'll see what I'm talking about. For example, you brought up the two roles of money, right? Money is a medium of exchange, right? We use it to transfer wealth from you to me, from me to you, for goods and services, right? If you want to go back to like Roman times, that's silver, right? And then money is a store of value. It has an almost finite supply. It has a very limited growth rate, and it erodes in value zero or little at all. And that would be gold. Silver is that way as well, but I just want to divide them for this conversation. So in the old days, I don't know what, 1969, gold was money and silver was change. You know, you use change to buy stuff, you use money to store your wealth. And that's still true in many cultures. Now, when you divide those two things, and you know, this is, I wouldn't say this is entirely new, but I haven't heard this type of conversation anywhere else. And I've come to this conclusion because of different parts of the economy and different parts of the government are acting in ways, when you combine them, it divides money. So we don't want money to be a store of value. We want money to be, we want, MMT wants money to flow. It wants money to facilitate economic growth. It right. doesn't want stores of value. It wants the store of value to be in the plumbing. It wants the store of value to be in the actual economic growth. The network, right, is mm-hmm. worth more than the thing. It doesn't want you hoarding money at all. So on that note, if you're an MMT person, you want money to flow, and you're an MMT person and you don't think money is an inflationary issue, you don't want money to be a store of value. You right. want businesses and things to be a store of value.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the path that I think answers your question by changing the subject. All right. What is a store of value if money isn't? And that you're getting into asset allocation. What is a store of value? I mean, fast forward, it's gold, it's silver, it's Bitcoin, if you're of that, you know, if you're of the mindset, which I am, it's oil, it's real estate, it's the business itself. Mm-hmm. So they want money to just be the literally, not even figurative anymore, the electrons that facilitate trade. They want movement. Movement is change. Movement is happiness. And I tell you, I was pulling my hair out on this stuff. Everything I just said to you, I came to a conclusion. I said, this is insane. I don't, you know, I can't wrap my head around it culturally. And
right.
I talked to, right? I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong. It's crazy. I'll say it's wrong because I've done the work. I won't say it's wrong because it just bothers me. It would bother me. And I'm like, what is this? And, you know, you hear a lot of people, it's communist, you know, et cetera. And I'm like, well, is it? I don't know. It turns out that everything I just said to you has amazingly a lot in common with Marxism. And I'm not a person who just read this stuff. So I didn't know it. I mean, I'm a capitalist.
I'm going to need you to expand on that for me, because it's funny. As you describe it, Vince, everything about it is sort of occurring to me as affirmation, right? Like, I think of my wealth as my real estate, my gold, my Bitcoin.
Right.
I do put cash in that bucket as well. I know some people say, whatever. But like, I hold
cash in that bucket. You just won't hold it there forever. Right. I understand.
Well, yeah. Not, I don't know about forever. Like my gold, for example, that, you know, I intend on just passing that to my kids. That's the game plan there, right? Continue to acquire gold throughout my life. And hopefully I never, ever need it. But it's that insurance policy in that worst case scenario, right? Real estate is similar to me. You know, Bitcoin is starting to occur that way to me. I've been acquiring Bitcoin without really a sound end game in my mind, because I'm like, I don't quite. Yeah, right. I know enough to absolutely want a sizable allocation, a horse in the race, whatever you want to call it, but I don't yet understand the future use case. And I'd challenge anybody who claims they do, like a 13-year-old technology. I don't think you can make a 50-year prediction. It's just ridiculous to me. But you know, enough has occurred that I definitely want that as part of my portfolio and a big part. And I keep dollars as well, because that just gives me the confidence to act on opportunities as they arise, right? And so
You're trading off a little bit of, and I think this is when you have dollars as opposed to putting your money in something immutable like gold or something that's valuable like art, you're trading off a little bit of security for liquidity, the ability to act.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why you have
it. 100%. 100%. Yeah. So based off everything you just shared, I have two directions I want to go here. You're drawing some comparisons between MMT and Marxism, which I'm curious about, because as you explain MMT, I'm like, that's how I think. You know, money is not my store of value, it's my transactional value. And then, but how does that, I guess, I want to talk about the Cantillon effect and how that may be occurring to us today. And then,
let's go
there first. And then I want to talk about your views on inflation, deflation, and where that lands.
Okay. Well, where would you like to start with the Cantillon effect?
Define it, first of all, for anyone who's not familiar what this is.
Well, I mean, people use the phrase a lot, and I got to tell you, I'm not textbook savvy on that. But really, for me, continuing effect is that inflation, right, will come up not all at once, but it'll come up in the form of malinvestment. And it will, I'm not really eloquent with this, but it kind of goes like this. We might be in the middle of it right now. Okay. That's really what I want to start with.
Okay.
We might be in the middle of it right now. It's kind of like we have inflation in cars, and then everybody buys a car. But because we're changing all our resources to build cars, then we have inflation in, and I'm making this part up, in refrigerators because metal's been used for that. And so what ends up happening is you have a market that chases need as it's going down the distribution line. And a big part of cotillion effect is a malinvestment of resources, a poor allocation of resources that is going to satisfy shorter-term events at the expense of longer-term prosperity.
Okay.
That's, I mean, there, you can probably say it better than I can. I feel it. I can't say it. You know, that's pretty much how I feel about it.
Right. Okay. Now, how does that, because the way I understand the cotillion effect is kind of like a, it's like a trigger point for greater inequality, right? To a degree.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. No, that, and you just said the same thing that I said in a much, much better way. Exactly it.
Well, I got it from your letter. So there it is.
Okay.
All right.
The it's a trigger point for inequality in the sense that, to simplify it, the cotillion effect is the inequality that I was describing was the inequality in goods produced. Everyone has a headache and everyone needs a pill for a headache, but resources are in the process of making, cars, and aspirin medicine goes into cars. I'm making this up, but you get my point.
Yeah.
Resources get poorly allocated. And so resources get poorly allocated. Goods get poorly allocated, not necessarily linearly. Resources get poorly allocated. Goods get poorly allocated. Decisions get poorly allocated. And you end up with an inequality at every level of life that manifests ultimately in the inequality of people. You have the K recovery, so to speak, right?
Yeah,
The bifurcation of the economy. So the cotillion effect, I was describing at its root, you're describing what ends up happening. Inequality is a manifestation of the cotillion effect and malinvestment and poor allocation of resources. I mean,
which yeah, is so I could relate that to maybe monetary policy, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Vince, but you know, the application is as the Fed expands their balance sheet, prints new money, that money trickles to those who need it least. Right.
Yeah.
The most affluent
that
banks.
Is the cotillion effect.
Right. That's, and Main Street is the last to receive those dollars. Therefore, get the least utility from those same dollars.
Correct.
That have already been. Okay.
So I have a question for you since you're educating me here. Are you ready? But I do have the answer. So I'm not going to stick.
Oh,
All right. No, but I had to look up the answer. This is the question that I asked myself. I would say that to myself and I'd say, well, how? The answer was, how did it not get to Main Street? Okay. So in 2008, 2009, how did the money not get from Wall Street to Main Street? And the answer was, eventually I found out the answer was, how did we end up with a cotillion effect to tie it all together, right? We ended up with it because the government, the Fed, instructed, because they were worried about inflation, basically instructed, they targeted what they wanted to go up. They didn't want money spent spuriously. They didn't want inflation. And so they said to the banks, here's the money. And unless you put it in something we approve of, I'm being figurative, but there were literal parts about this. Here's the money. Unless you put it in things that we approve of, we're not going to give it to you. So that's a generalization. But I had to drill down into really what that meant. And what it meant was when the Fed printed all this extra money in 2000. Now, we're talking about now as well, but then it worked, right? When the Fed printed, when the government printed all this extra money, the Fed made it available, provided you had a higher balance sheet, higher requirements for your balance sheet. So it's kind of like you and I are going for a mortgage, right? And you're a multimillionaire and I've got a net worth of $50 and they've lowered interest rates to zero. Well, that, even though we're not talking about that, and they've printed more money, there's plenty of money out there. but they raise requirements for us to buy a house from 10% down payment to 30%. I can't buy a house.
Right.
You can. And so what that does is by raising, almost like raising fiscal requirements, you negate the monetary effect. And you're kind of creating, pathways for the money to go that they want it to go.
Yes.
And I'm speaking figuratively now. I'll give you something literal. They created, the Fed created the repo account, the reverse repo account. The reverse repo account very quickly is if a bank has too much cash, the Fed will take that cash and hold it for a day and give you interest overnight.
Yeah.
So it's reverse. We have cash. We have extra liquidity we don't need. What do we do with it? Well, if the Fed, so the Fed created that vehicle, and Paulson even alluded to this. That was his mistake when he bought gold back in 2011. When the Fed created this vehicle, they encouraged, I don't know how you encourage, but I'm sure there's a way to do it. They encouraged the banks to put their money in there for 5 basis points instead of loaning it to you and me so we can buy our fifth house. And so they adeptly kept inflation down. It actually was a successful process. I'm not saying, what ends up happening is anything that's successful ends up becoming the second time around abused. And I think that's what we're in the process of now. But that's what ended up happening. They printed all this money and through what's called through policies, the money never got into the world. And so you had a situation where we didn't have inflation and you minimized inflation, you maximized the cotillion effect. The money went, bringing it back to what you said, the money went where it wasn't needed.
Right.
And it makes absolute sense if you put yourself in the shoes of those bankers, not necessarily that I agree with it, but you know, it's a highly criticized policy because that money wasn't lent out to the people who needed it the most.
Right.
But put yourselves in the hands, in the minds of the lender. Who are you going to lend the money to, right? The sure bet.
Well, I mean,
right?
That's exactly right. I mean, if I'm a loan officer and I have two customers, one of which is a completely irresponsible person who's down on his luck, and one of which is a very responsible person who's down on his luck, I have to pick who to give that money to. Mm-hmm. And I'm a human being picking that. And the Fed's saying, we don't want you to make that choice. Just give us the money.
Yes.
We don't want you to create an inflationary environment by giving it to someone irresponsibly. And so they took the individuality of the bank's loan officer away from him. And in doing so, the money only went to people who didn't need it, creditworthy. But who at the same time, you know, I mean, there's plenty of credit worthy people who aren't responsible. That's probably where it went, you know?
Sure.
So that's how they chose the evil of the cotillion effect over the evil of an accelerated inflationary environment.
What's up, everybody? Sorry for the interruption. Quick note, if you enjoy these conversations, I publish a weekly newsletter and it's free, where I share my top takeaways, lessons learned, and any action steps I might be taking as a consequence in the market. Sign up at cambridgehouse.com. I publish every week and it's free. Now back to the conversation. As we gravitate towards modern monetary theory, you know, how does this process, which we've just spent the last 5 minutes discussing, is that impacted? And if so, how? What's the intention? What's the intention behind modern monetary
theory? Oh, now I see what you're saying. Okay. Go back to the beginning. Modern monetary theory believes that money is an impediment to growth. The hoarding of money is an impediment to growth. Therefore, we need to think about this over two generations. We need to convince people that money is puka shells. We need to convince people that their value isn't physical. It's in the ether. It's in the network. It's in the business. It's in the intellectual capital. It's in your mind. It's in your sweat.
It's in productivity. Okay,
in getting us from the point we are now, right, to that point, it's kind of like getting us from gold to NFTs as money, you know, JPEGs as money. What they have to do is they have to, I think I'm pretty good at predicting 5 and 10 years out. 5 and 10 minutes out, though, I have no idea. So So let's stay with 5 and 10 years, because if I'm wrong, you can't get back to me. I won't be here anymore. The question, if I understand it correctly, is what is indicative or what is involved in the process from here to full-blown MMT, right?
Yeah.
Is that it? Okay. Yeah. So just to digress for a second, I think the store of value medium exchange aspect. There is an analogy that people say that money is the lifeblood of the economy, right? And in using that analogy to split store of value and medium of exchange, people I think might understand that at a much more visceral level. Blood is made up of plasma and blood cells, right? Right. So plasma, among other things, but its primary value, in my opinion, we teach a little chemistry and biology in my spare time, is to bring blood cells from point A to point B. So it's a lubricant. It's the medium of transfer, right? It is the medium of transfer. It is the liquidity, literally, literally, right? Right. What's the store of value?
The blood cells.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So what they're saying is, we don't want the store of value in the pipeline anymore. We don't want the store of value in the liquidity. We want the liquidity to just be the liquidity. And the store of value is what it ends up with. Now, we can get into where that analogy breaks down, but I wanted to bring that up because when you separate the two, they want the blood of the economy to be plasma. They want it to just be moving. They want it to be the handshake that closes a deal. Mm. So now we bring it to what is indicative of that or what is part of that process. Well, if you could do it overnight, you would do the following. If I were in charge, if you could do it overnight and people understood and agreed with you, you would do this overnight, you would say this, right? There's no more cash. You need to abandon physicality, right? There's no more cash. There's no cash, then there's nothing physical to hoard, right? And we're almost there, right? Okay. The next step would be to create a digital dollar. And the reason I focus on this is because that's why it's almost fortuitous for MMT people that Bitcoin came along. Now, Bitcoin is a store of value, right? Right? Because it's limited. Whether you believe it's a store of value because it's low volatility, you'd be crazy. But you know, maybe someday it will be. But that's not what we're talking about here. Sure. But there's a limited amount of it. So literally, MMT says money is no object. There will be an unlimited amount of money and it will be digital. So now you have digital dollars. You don't have cash. Obviously, this won't happen all at once. You don't have cash. You create digital dollars. You make people see dollars digitally as a transactional thing, as a handshake, as a deal, as an exchange of services, as a contract itself. And so get rid of cash, create a digital dollar. And this is where that whole cotillion effect comes in. Dissuade people from hoarding money. Meaning, CIA just hoarding money, you no longer call it money. From hoarding value, from storing value. And if I print infinite money, then money is worth nothing, but it's a contract in and of itself. You know, it's like we did a deal, right? Mm-hmm. So where am I going to put my store of value? Okay, I have made X amount of dollars and I want to save some for my kids. Well, this is where the whole Marxism thing will back into it. It's like, well, we don't want you to save. That money is going to go back to the state. I'm not being paranoid. I'm just stating the extremes of Marxism and stuff like that. And the state will take care of you. And in the meantime, you don't need to have cash on hand to buy an investment. But more important, because you're going to have cash, you have cash flow, right? Think about fundamentals. We went from income statements to cash flow models. It's not how much money you make. It's so long as you can service your debt. It has to keep flowing. So cash flow models are all about the flow of money. So now the state says to you, you don't need to buy store value. You don't need gold. You don't need these things. You don't need silver. You don't need to own hard assets. And in the back of my mind, I hear WEF saying, you'll own nothing and be happy. That's another part of the world that's telling you that MMT is consistent with their ideology. We're talking about ideology, and I'm not paranoid. I'm not end of the world stuff here. I'm talking about ideology, and ideology frames behavior better than where the market is. So we've removed cash, right? We've done this in 5 minutes, right? You and I have removed cash, right? Right. We've created a digital dollar, and now we need to dissuade people, as I just started to get into, we need to dissuade people from hoarding money. We want it to flow, okay? Mm. How do you stop people from hoarding money? How do you stop people from using safe havens? You need them to have trust. They need to have trust. They need to believe that their safety be taken care of. And that's what the state would sell. That's the carrot, right?
Yeah.
Well, the stick is any sales of gold are 40% tax. If you sell your house, it's a 40% tax. Now, I'm not making that up. I mean, I had a friend in Argentina. When they devalued the peso, the Argentinian peso, it was pegged to the dollar artificially, one for one, let's say. Then they devalued it, and it went to four, let's say. He goes, but I owned a house. And I went, okay, so that's great. So your house went from being worth 100,000 pesos to being worth 400,000 pesos because of the depegging. Your house is still a house.
Yeah.
It's still worth $100,000. It's just 400,000 pesos now. He goes, yes. I go, so what happened? He goes, well, this is where I think MMT has a practical problem. He said, well, they raised taxes from 10% to 40% on house sales. So if you sold your house, you gave the money back almost to the letter that you made. I mean, not almost the letter, but a large chunk of it. So they raised, so they decoupled. And then what they did was they actually, and this works. This is actually like a communist concept. They decoupled, they let the currency float, they raised taxes, which keeps inflation under pressure, which slows the velocity of money down, but steals wealth from the person who bought the house. So that's the concept there. So we've hit the three things that we need to do that are indicative of MMT being employed. One is, I mean, you're going to sell them all the way on this, but you have to remove cash. We don't have change. You know, we don't want to make change. We're going to get rid of the $100 bill or the 100 rupee bill. Mm-hmm. So you slowly get rid of change. We're going to charge you, by the way, when you go to an ATM, if they charge you $2, they're charging you for your money. And I'm not being paranoid about it. But meanwhile, if you remember 20 years ago, you're pretty young compared to me, I think. But 20 years ago, you would be charged to electronically transfer money. And the ATM was free. Now the ATM charges you $2 and the electronic transfer is free. It's right. Cheaper to send money electronically. So the way that you do this, the way that you implement these concepts that we're talking about, is you make physical cash compete with virtual cash economically. I charge you $2 to use an ATM, but you can use Zelle for free now and it's quicker. Why would you use cash? So you make it economically. It's, you know, it's like if in the whole vaccination thing, whole vaccination mandate. Okay, you have free will. You can get a vaccine or don't get a vaccine. Well, you can do whatever you want, but you can't work on government property if you don't have a vaccine. And I'm not political about it. I'm just saying that's what you do when you want to force an issue, which is really what you're asking. How would they force the issue? You would do it by making changes and making those changes economically incompatible with how you live.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are the three things.
Yeah. Vince, how do you react to this? So, you know, keep in mind, like I'm a recreationalist, you know, I try to understand these subjects better. I'm no expert. I get to ask questions for a living. That's rad. Right. But, you know, as you walk me through this, like I can feel my back getting up. I can feel like I odd desires. Like I don't own enough firearms. I want more gold in my safe. Like,
oh my
I
God.
Immediately charged. To right. protect any sovereignty, right? Like it's my immediate reaction to that.
I've run into three types of people who have varying levels of understanding of these concepts, and putting myself in your category, right? Okay, so we're in the same category. There's the person who doesn't understand much about it, but is in an uproar about it. And you know what? Maybe they don't know what they're talking about, but they're right. Then there's the person who says, who's, I think, where you and I are. And that person is like, I don't want to give up complete faith in how our government takes care of us. But by the same token, I've got to take care of my family. And so my emotional reaction is to I don't have enough firearms, by the way, you know, which is what you said. And I would say to you, no, you don't have enough bullets, right? And what I mean by that is, you control guns by controlling the amount of bullets.
Yeah.
We're allowed to have guns, you know, anyway, but not to make this a gun conversation, but to answer your question, I mean, the feeling that you just described, I have that every day when I think about this. I had that an hour before we talked because I was doing some more research. And I'm like, you know, the fear of like, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing it right. Oh my God, I've been deluding myself. I'm sorry to say this, but I don't know. I think once you want to, let's say you and I are completely incompatible human beings, but we have the same visceral reaction. I think we have to like, you know, hold hands and say, okay, we both just freaked out about this. Now let's go and figure out what's best for ourselves and we'll compare notes.
Sure.
But let's not, I don't know what the answer is. You know, it's like I can see the negative in everything. That's a risk manager, not as a cynic. So I'm like, I want to buy gold, but when I sell it, they're going to tax me. I want to buy another house. When I sell it, they're going to, I want to hold cash. Well, they're going to debase it. What do I do? Well, they want you to put it in stocks. They'll make it competitive. So maybe I'll put it in an ETF that's based on real estate. You know, I don't know. So it becomes, sadly, even more or even less a stock picker's market. You start picking asset classes. So I don't have an easy, I guess what I'm saying in a long-winded way is I don't have an easy answer for that one. I feel like, to use an analogy that someone described to me one time, I feel like a sandwich being eaten right now. I haven't digested everything and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And I'm like, okay, but I will say this, 5 to 10 years from now, this stuff is happening. It's happening unless there's an ideological change, which would come from, sadly, a serious crash, a war, or some event that turns everything upside down, like a Great Depression. Because that's the way ideas work. They keep doing pot odds until they've been proven wrong.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. And when I say I want to own more farms, it's because I hunt. I like my independence. You know, I live in a small mountain town.
I get it.
I'm not about to take up arms over here, but I want to be able to take care of myself. And the last thing I'm ever going to do is put my future. I have 3 young kids, put their future in the hands of anybody else. Not a chance, right?
But by the same token, and this is where people have to think about this all the time, you know, and I'm not saying that you're feeling this right now, and I'm not either, but as a law-abiding citizen, and which we all are, who's setting example for our children, and you're given, let's say that what I said happened tomorrow, well, that's chaos. You know, you have to choose between you don't want to, but I can imagine myself saying, well, you know, I mean, it's like someone in a Great Depression. Would you steal bread to feed your family? Yes. Well, where's your line? I don't know where my line is. And I'm just getting to the point where it kind of gets muddy if this stuff goes down.
And the line moves. There's no line. The line is completely based off your set and setting, right? What you're willing to do is completely dependent on your environment, right? That line is very fluid.
Right. Exactly. I can't add to that, except the line is fluid. It changes from year to year in your children's age. It changes from year to year in your economic development, your age, your relationships. It changes, you know, I mean, I'm not going to take my bicycle, off of a ramp anymore, you know,
right.
In terms of risk.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's some, to me, it appears dystopian, but I, you know, it's funny because I'm an optimist, like to a fault, you know, I think any entrepreneur needs to be right. You need to persevere when everything's dark, but, and I will also bet all day on human ingenuity. You know, my whole life has been a bull market. I'm 37 years old every year, better access to food, better access to healthcare. You know, everything about my life has improved. I'm in Canada, right? Like it's just been a 37 year bull market. There's been ups and downs, but in general, right? Like our lives are better than they used to be, right?
That's right.
And you could say that about the last 100 years easily. But, you know, when you walk through this, you know where my mind goes? I wonder about the world my kids will live in. I have 3 kids under 6, right? 1, 3 and 5 years old. And I wonder about the world they'll live in with, you know, how we'll continue to integrate our lives into the digital world, right? And like, you know, everyone's talking about the metaverse today, and I've got buddies now who are plugged in, you know, and you know, it's interesting to watch the shift in their psychology already. So a good friend of mine, very successful entrepreneur, and suddenly he got into gaming with he's got one of the Oculus headsets, and he's now gaming 3 hours a day. For the first time in his life, he was a professional climber back in his youth, became an entrepreneur, just, you know, a go-getter. He's now plugged in 3 hours a day. And the last 2 times I've talked to him, he's like, Jay, I don't know what's going on, but I'm waking up in the morning and I'm just not inspired to build my business anymore. And I'm not feeling the drive anymore. You think there's a relationship here. Like you're literally unplugging from reality to plug into this false reality where anything, and I don't gamble, I shouldn't be talking about it, but like it's a distortion.
I can relate your description because I go through that. No, look, someone close to me was on the spectrum. They actually grew out of it on the autistic spectrum. And to educate yourself on that, you have to learn about executive function. And you have to learn that about Pavlovian stuff and the fact that video games, because it was about video games with this person. And I wanted to make sure that what they watched didn't stimulate them without the hard work. It's almost like a Protestant work right. ethic concept. Yeah. So if you get stimulated too much without the work, like drugs, right? You tend to not do the work. And even if you're not physically addicted, you're socio-psychologically addicted. And what ends up happening is, I'll give you an example I think your audience might appreciate. If you have kids and your kids watch two shows, I'll give you two shows that are, and hopefully you're not sponsored by either one of these. There's Old School Blue's Clues and there's, let's say, Diego, Dora's cousin.
Okay.
It sounds like I'm going off the rails here, but I'm speaking to what your friend's talking about. Okay. So the person who developed Blue's Clues understood that the mind can be distracted by fast movements, almost like your grandparents would say to you, you know, it's too flashy. And so what they did was if you watch one of those episodes, whoever the main character is, Joe or Steve, he walked in the frame and the frame never moved. Okay. All right. He walked in the frame never moved. You go to Diego, who's a step worse than Dora. Diego stood in the middle of the frame, and behind him, the scenery moved very fast.
Okay.
So even if the content were exactly the same, I think it's autonomic. Part of your nervous system is being triggered to watch that. So it's a little bit of caffeine. It's a little bit of like hitting the like button on Twitter. And I think your friend may not be as brilliant as he is. He may not be, and I'll tell you, this is the arrogance. I'm speaking about myself here. This is the hubris of thinking, I'm bigger than that. I can control that. And before you know it, it's a mild addiction, like sugar.
Yes.
6 months down the road, you're like, geez, you know, if I don't have any sugar, I end up picking up a bottle of Snapple or something. What I'm getting at is he may not even know it, but he's in this mild addiction.
Oh, 100%.
Tell him to go watch. Tell them to go watch Blue's Clues instead of Dora.
Or
but anyway, that's the concept. The concept is it really destroys your incentive to do.
Well, which is a kind of, to me, it's a bit of a scary parallel development to everything you just discussed with MMT. You will own nothing and be happy. Plus, here's, you know, the next generation of escapism to ensure you're satisfied or at least distracted from what's occurring around you.
Okay, I can freak you out a little bit more. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Do it. Yeah, let's go.
For a second. Okay, all right. First of all, let me just say this. I am not cynical and I am not dystopian. Right now, I'm looking for ways not just to manage my finances or protect my family. I'm looking for optimistic signs, you know? So I want you to understand that I'm not here to say it's the end of the world. I'm here to say challenges are ahead. And more people who think like you, more people who think that way need to be more informed so we can be on the ready and not have to wait for a report from 60 Minutes, you know, to tell us that we've been had, you know, something like that. And I mean this educationally. All right. So I'm going to throw this at you. This is scary stuff. Okay. But but you're probably going to say, oh yeah, it makes sense. All right. So DARPA, right? And I'm not going down a rabbit hole. This is about, look, there are good people and bad people, just to simplify the world, right? Right? Good people want good, bad people want bad. And, you know, the even if they want to portray themselves as being good, but, you know, they're in the pursuit of, the point is, if you give power to the wrong people, that power can be abused. Okay. So one of the powers that they're going to have soon, digitally speaking, you know, Neuralink, right? The Elon Musk thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's been around for a while, for about 20 years. And here's what they figured out. What they figured out is, and this is part of what Zuckerberg is doing too. They figured out that we know this. You don't think, maybe we don't think about it, we know this. The moment that you make up your mind to do something, And the moment that you do it, there's a lag. I'm going to press this keyboard. There's a lag. But your nerves have already moved. Nerves have already moved. And that's why people talk about tells, like maybe you blink or something like that. Okay. All right. So what I think it was DARPA. What DARPA wanted to do is they wanted to figure out what spots controlled what stuff. So they popped something on a rat. And after a while, very simple stuff, but they figured out how to get the rat through the maze. They make the rat turn left. They make the rat turn left. They make the rat turn right. And so the point is, what they wanted to do is they wanted to see what part of the brain controls what. But it's two-way. It's two-way. And what I mean by two-way is this. If you can find the spot that controls the behavior, then you can input into the spot to change the behavior. Okay? So you and I, and I'm gonna give you the optimist ending here. Okay? We're good.
Please.
We're gonna be okay. What they realize is that, and I haven't seen the proof on this, I haven't had the citation yet, but they've tested it on humans. And what ends up happening is it's kind of like front running algorithms. Okay. I've made up my mind that I'm going to hit enter. Before I hit it, I made up the mind there's a lag. Well, they have an algorithm that's going back to them saying his neurons or whatever is in here changed, saying he's going to hit enter. They know it before I do it. They know it in that lag. It's scary stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, you talk about, you know, your back getting tense, you know, that's kind of, that makes me think, you know, okay, in my spare time, I pretend to read philosophy. Well, am I really in control of anything that I do? You know? Okay. Yeah. So that's where the whole Elon Musk story goes. So, but there's an answer. And the answer is, and this is why your friend needs to get off of the video screen and I need to stop hitting the like button on Twitter. And we need to keep our kids away from that. And here's the answer. The answer is the word no. Meaning you may make up your free will is in the word no. I'm going to hit the enter button. I've already made up my mind neurologically to do it. You have to say no just to pause to give yourself your control back. Mm. So, you know, it's not a battle cry, but the point is the video stuff that's out there, the social media that's out there, it's all about getting over on impulses. You know, like you're at the cash register. I want a pack of gum. You get a pack of gum. No is the hard thing to do when the money's in your head. And that's one of the ways you make central bank digital currency easy. You make it easy. You make it convenient. And when you have technology behind you, whether it be DARPA or something else, or a video game, you make it dystopian. The answer is people need to say no, and not for a negative reason. People need to say, like your grandmother, or like my grandmother would say, why don't you wait a couple of days and tell me if you still feel that way?
Mm.
And so I think, and you know, we talked about this before we started, talk about long form and short form in terms of media.
Yeah. Well,
long form decision. Long-form media, slowing things down will give you back your self-control. Anyway, so all I'm saying is, God forbid, heaven forbid, if dumb or worse, evil smart people get access to these technologies and use them in a way to do something more than to get me to buy a turtleneck on Amazon.
Sure. Anyway. Yeah, which is inevitable. I mean, it's. You're absolutely right. I hadn't really walked down that path with, you know, I guess, metaverse applications, but I've interviewed Christopher Wiley before. He was one of the architects at Cambridge Analytica, you know, when that whole thing came out where we were exposed to how manipulated and influential our social media feeds are at encouraging ideas and opinions. And communities around those, right? And like, very, very powerful at changing the direction of culture, right? And that's from like a sort of distant interface, being a phone or a laptop or an iPad. Whereas if you're in the world, I mean, the opportunities to change your behavior are somewhat horrifying. I love the power is in the no. You know, I have this mantra, it's on my whiteboard. It just says, pause, think, act. And what that means to me is like, if I'm engaging in a conversation, debate, or argument, or an interview with you, you know, whatever that is, and you say something and I react to that, right? Or whether it's an argument with my wife, maybe, right? Like something close to home, right? And we all feel that reaction, that reactive response. But I know it's I'm way, like I'll be it's way happier if I pause, I think, and then I act instead of reacting. And that little shift, which takes practice, right? And you fail at it. I fail at it all the time. But when I get it right. I
mean, it's, I remember as a kid, you know, be positive. Don't say no. You know what? It's not that kind of no.
No.
It's, I'm saying no to myself. I'm not saying no to you. I'm saying no to myself. So I guess we're back to like the Nancy Reagan era. We should just say no.
Yeah.
Right? But anyways, so imagine this. Imagine, I mean, you know, whatever Facebook is now, Meta, I mean, your hand probably touches the mouse before it presses the button a little bit before. I mean, we just need to be careful. We need to be aware, and we need to use these things for the right reasons.
So yeah. It's not easy. I like it, man. I like it. We need more conversations like this, more people like you, Vince. I think that's important right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I've seen some of the people that you've interviewed, and your format's great. And I mean, look, there are plenty of places I'd love to have a conversation like this with, but the format doesn't promote it, and that's fine. But for a first conversation, I can't believe you let me do all this. I'll be regretting it right now, right?
No, man, no. I'd love to do it again. It was fascinating. I'm bummed we ran out of time. That's the thing, right? Like, you know, we before we hit record, we were talking about, you know, is, in my hope, is long form media taking over for short form? And it is and it isn't, right? It's simultaneously happening in both directions, right? We're moving to like 15-second updates over here, but then some of the biggest platforms in the world are now gravitating towards much longer form, in-depth conversation. That's the way that we should go on that pause, think, act, slow down, you know, that's consider your responses. Anyways, this has been great. Super fun, actually. Really, really fun conversation. And we covered so much that I was really curious about. And like, I feel like increased my level of understanding of a handful of important topics. So that's why I knew this, man.
You've helped me too. I mean, you know, I really never was able to describe what Cantillon effect was until you effect was. I mean, I just like, it's stuff gets screwed up, but yeah, that's it. I appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. Okay. We got to do it again. Thanks again. And I appreciate your time, man.
Peace. Thank you so much.
If you enjoy my content, do me a favor, follow or subscribe to this podcast, drop me a rating and review, and share this with a friend. All of these things allow me to get bigger and better guests on the show. Now you can catch me all over social media at JMartinBC. Thanks for tuning in.